morning. As uncertainty continues over the Affordable Care Act, Hawaii now has a waiver for the ACA Small Business Health Options Program. In his last weeks as head of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, George Green offers a benediction of sorts on Hawaii's healthcare future. And contributing editor Neil Milner gives us the long view of a friendship that changed the way two researchers changed their minds about changing minds. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Actors Group production Yellow Man looks at the class divisions within America's black community in a two-character memory play. And Sharon Stone's new musical, Old Girls Looking Hot, takes on the thorny subject of growing old in a youth-obsessed culture.
It's Wednesday, January 4th. The conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. A number of things lately have made us wonder how people manage their own affairs and whether or not they always act in their own interests, driven by logic. Yeah.
Well, again, that's the point. We always had this idea for many, many years that if people were presented with enough information that that would lead to a certain outcome. But, you know, we've had lots of examples of that.
I can think of a few.
Well, you know, we hear a lot about these, a lot these days about data-driven results. But as we've just been talking about, do people really make decisions based on logic? Decades ago, a friendship between two researchers led to discoveries that changed collective thinking about how people think. A new biography of the two researchers, written by writer Michael Lewis, provides a reminder why, even in the face of data and logic, people often do anything but what was once expected by that idea of the rational man. Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now with a look at the Undoing Project, a friendship that changed our minds. Good morning.
Good morning.
So who were these two researchers and when did they meet?
Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman were researchers, psychologists who really began their career in Israel. They studied psychology in Israel, sort of, because there really wasn't much of a psychology department there, and that became important. They stayed on there. Kahneman had originally was an immigrant from Europe. Tversky had been there for a long time. They ended up in the United States, but relatively late in their careers. They were already famous. These two guys, the story of the book is really two stories. It's about what these two people find and how that collaboration, which is very interesting, how that friendship really worked. Just one other thing, Kahneman won a Nobel Prize for his findings, and Amos Tversky certainly would have also won one, but he died young from cancer, and you have to be alive in order to get the Nobel Prize.
What they discovered was really groundbreaking. It changed the long-held idea that, as we talked about a moment ago, if you give people enough empirical data, you show them what the facts are, that will lead them to a certain conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, the subtitle of the book gets it pretty much, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. It changed our minds about the way our minds work, and their findings were so important that not only did they change psychology and created a whole new field in economics, even though they weren't economists, but also part of the culture, part of the way we now talk about ourselves are this. Basically what they found, and the best way to express it is thinking about economics. The way we used to think about economics is to assume that a person was rational, that he or she was a utility maximizer. That is, you looked out there to see, these are my wants, and I'm going to get all the information I can to get it. Well, it turns out that's not how we think, that we use data in order, and they discovered this through experiments. We use data, but the data we use is basically stories, heuristics. The way we decide whether we're likely to do something, and this applies to economic decisions and also to other things, including political things, is essentially to grab what is most compelling in our mind, most recent in our mind that we think applies to it. So you're using empirical data, but in very different ways. It's a kind of biased sort of data that's not necessarily representative, but it's compelling. It's in our heads. And that's how people make economics decisions, and that's what they show is how people make other kinds of decisions. It's a fundamentally different way to think about ourselves, and they do these experiments that show how accurate it is.
When you talk about behavioral economics, that was up until that point not even a field of study. We never talked about behavioral economics. Also, the fact that in politics we see that stories become so much a part of how policy is discussed or how people are made to sway in one direction or another, even in the face of conflicting facts. At this point, though, it also looks like this is a case for the outlier because they were allowed to develop these ideas without a lot of conventional thought that began to massage it, or even an institution that caused them to go down a certain path.
That's absolutely right. This, to me, as fascinating as understanding their findings, and Michael Lewis does a good job of doing that, is the story about how they work. Now, remember who Michael Lewis is. Michael Lewis wrote he wrote The Big Short, he wrote Moneyball, all of those are, and he wrote other things about football. All of those feature people from unconventional backgrounds that had a very important effect on the fact that they thought in different ways. They're more likely to be outside of it. And these two men had a very unconventional background. And until they ended up in great American universities, they learned all of this stuff somewhere else and they carried it forward. So they were not economists, and that let them discover this kind of stuff. In fact, they were amazed when they did this research. They weren't thinking of economics at all because they were in another field. And their feeling about economists was that these guys are snotty. They don't really care what psychologists find. And the power of their findings were so great that it's very much transformed the field of economics. Behavioral economics now, I think every assistant professor who comes out in economics knows something or actually does stuff that way. So it is a story about how unconventional thinking is developed. And part of it had to do with the two people collaborating in such fundamental ways, and some of it had to do with the fact they come out of a very, very different background.
In some ways, though, has this now become conventional thought?
Yeah, it's conventional thought. It's maybe too conventional thought because what happens when it becomes part of the culture is people make it more simplistic. But it certainly is conventional in very important ways. It's the way that we think about economics now. It's the way if a lot of the things that I've said about voters and how people make political decisions in John Haidt's work comes out of this tradition. And even Michael Lewis said, I wrote a lot about outliers and how these people made decisions, knowing nothing about Kahneman and Tversky's work. And I was astonished when I went back and started looking at these people after I wrote, say, Moneyball, to see how much their work was fundamentally a part of it.
Which is to say how much it infuses our culture and we don't even know it or give credit to those who came up with it in the first place.
That's right. It's infused our culture in some very important ways, but it's very hard to get people to understand how much it's part of their thinking. People resist it when you talk about politics. But remember the 2016 presidential campaign and what a masterful storyteller Donald Trump is and how post-truth has now become a kind of term. In lots of ways, that's very scary because it really shows the power of stories and it really shows the kinds of irrational side of politics on both sides. It's not very different from what we've seen in the past. It's just a more exaggerated side of it. And it should remind everybody that the idea that politics is irrational, or as one psychologist put it, it's much more like rooting for a home team than it is like looking for information that's more objective, is a very much a part of political life.
Which kind of goes back to the ideas that we've talked about many times, that we go to seek agreement. We don't necessarily look for ideas that are different.
Yes. Let me add one other thing about the power of stories. this book is powerful because Lewis is a masterful storyteller, and he's able to take complex data and put it in the form of story so that people like you and me get convinced by it. And that's essentially a microcosm of what Kahneman and Tversky show about the way we think.
In the paradigm that we now live with all of this, is there some good news about this too, aside from just the suspicion that we need to have when we hear stories?
So we live in paradigm, not paradise. Is that what you're saying?
We do.
We're storytelling people. I come into a lot of this through the process of storytelling because I've done that as part of my own work. And as Kahneman said, you give people data and you give people stories, people will accept the stories and not the data. I think that's the part of how we are, but it doesn't mean that we're totally hardwired that way and that it's
Well, think about fake news, for example.
Fake news is – that has to do – all right, let's think about fake news for a second. It certainly is appealing because we're storytellers, but we certainly have the capacity to ask questions about the nature and the validity and the truth of the stories.
The question is, do we? And
The answer is not significantly enough because we tend to accept information that appeals to what we believe beforehand, but we have to learn certain kind of critical – redevelop our critical faculties to deal with it.
All right. One model goes away. We have another one. And will there be something else that moves along even after that?
Yes. I agree.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We'll talk in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us every other week with a look at the long view.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15. Coming up, a new play at the Actors Group considers the politics of color. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're remembering the first television series set in Hawaii, and no, it wasn't Five-0. We're thinking about Hawaiian Eye, a show that ran from 1959 to 1963 on ABC. Its tone was more lighthearted and smart-mouthed than the deadly serious Five-0, and much of that was due to the presence of a wisecracking Waikiki cab driver who was a sidekick to the show's Private Eyes, played by Robert Conrad and Anthony Isley. The character of the cabbie became an integral part of the show, instantly identifiable by his straw hat and his ukulele. He served as the all-purpose informant, who always seemed to know someone in the Hawaii underworld to assist the detectives with their inquiries. This Maui-born singer and comedian went on to appear in an Elvis Presley film after the show's run and toured the world with his nightclub act. This morning, we're looking for his name, and we'll be back with it in half an hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Good morning. I'm Byron Gu from the T-Chess. You're listening to The Conversation on HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio.
Within Black America, there are long-standing hierarchies based on skin color, a troubling example of the ways an oppressed people are encouraged to oppress themselves. Yellow Man, a new production of the Actors Group, takes a hard look at a discomforting reality Derek Brown is the director, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning. Good morning.
Maybe we should start out by talking about the title and what it implies, and also the use of terms like high yellow.
Okay. Yellow Man and terms like Yellow Man are references made to mulatto or biracial people.
Mm-hmm.
There are many names associated with the colorism of an individual, from the darkest, meaning, let's say, blackie, to half-breed, yellow man, light-skinned, high yellow.
Yeah.
All of these are really derogatory terms used within the community and sometimes outside the community, but more within the community.
Yeah.
So without being too offensive, it would be used in a derogatory manner. And it usually it has its rootings in slavery times, when the slave master would rape the slaves. And the offspring usually turned out lighter skinned. Of course, the offspring were treated better.
Yeah.
This gave way to the house Negro, field Negro mentality. So,
right. Lighter skinned in the house with the easier jobs, the more privileged position.
Ate better.
Yeah.
But the mentality was they were made to feel as if they were part of the team. If there was a rebellion going out in the field, people were trying to learn to read, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you make sure you keep an eye on those people, because we have to protect our house. So even though, of course, there was no ownership from the slave, they were made to feel as if, you know, they were a part of the collective. So, in fact, they would inform on if there was a rebellion, people were trying to escape, or people were trying to learn to read, they would let the master know.
And this is an oppressed people oppressing themselves.
Sure.
And yet, and the whole idea of being given a few privileges might make you feel as if the house was yours when it's really not.
Well, I would think so. The conditions that they had to live in back in that time, anything was a step up, was a come up. So sure, you know, if you can eat a little better, stay a little warmer, avoid a few whippings, then you did. You felt like you were part of the winning team. So it wouldn't be hard for you to, quote unquote, sell out.
Turn against your own.
Sure.
But which you no longer see as your own because maybe you look a little different.
Right, right. And well, the term that is used to describe this kind of disparity within our own race has been given a term now called colorism.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess colorism is within the race, how we use, you know, the way we discriminate against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And just with the images that you see, a young child, you know, sees as far as beauty and all that is right, it's unless you have a good base in your parents, which is what happened to me, you know, really let you know about your history through. I had a library over hundreds of books that our father, me and my sister, he would make us read, you mm-hmm. know, just to educate ourselves so we know our history. Mm-hmm. I mean, from its inception and in the Middle Passage up to now. So we had a little bit, you know, education, of course, is the key.
This is growing up where, Derek?
In White Plains, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me think, really, and especially in the East Coast, you have the legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Sure.
Who, you know, promulgated the whole idea of celebrating African identity, celebrating a cultural identity as something to be proud of.
Right.
Very influential in that, you know, in Harlem and in East Coast Black America,
sure,
particularly. Yeah?
Sure. And Marcus Garvey surely had a message of, he was trying to tell people that you can do this. I mean, because many people had that defeatist attitude. You know, you can have your own businesses. You can do this. We can. You know, he had Black Star Lines. Of course, it didn't succeed. But as I understand it, I mean, there may have been some agitators that wanted to make sure that he didn't succeed.
Oh, there were a lot of people interested in having it not succeed.
Sure, sure.
But how does this all play out on stage in the play Yellow Man? All these identity politics.
The identity politics, in my opinion, creates a dysfunction. The two main characters in the play, the light-skinned man who is, quote-unquote, Yellow Man, his parents are he has a dark-skinned father and a light-skinned mother. And the other character is a dark-skinned woman who has just the opposite. Now, the woman's mother, she, how can I say this? She hated herself. The mom hated herself. She always held a candle for a quote-unquote light-skinned man who would somehow return one day and take her and her daughter out of the country where they wouldn't have to sweep chicken stuff. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have to tend to the garden, so on and so forth. This man does appear in the play, and he turns out to be an alcoholic. He is light-skinned, which is the only thing that matters. He doesn't he speaks to them like they're animals. He shows no love. As a matter of fact, the character lets her know that he'll never love her. So, but she still holds out hope because
she looks past that.
She thinks that if they had been somehow born light-skinned, that their life would be a lot easier. Actually, the story is a tragedy.
Yeah.
Without giving away too much of it. It's a love story, but at the same time, it's a tragedy that is based in realness. Because it is a real thing. It's a fictional story, but then again, it's written as a fictional story. But these are the experiences of the author, Dale Orlando Smith. So I can't say exactly what she went through, but it just creates dysfunction to where this dysfunction is put in a pot and it just boils over.
Yeah.
Because it affects everything. The son, the light-skinned son and the dark-skinned father don't get along because the dark-skinned father resents his own offspring, which is something that it's hard to imagine. But history has taught him he's a dark-skinned man. Nothing was given to him. He had to work really hard for everything he got, and he feels that everything is handed to his son.
As he resents that.
A light-skinned person. He represents everything that has oppressed him within his own culture.
Yeah.
And he hates him for it.
Yeah.
Eventually, the son ends up hating the father. And the mother and the daughter, they have the same issue.
That's a powerful message in that you don't have to wait around for the white man to hate you.
Right. Right. And this is that's exactly right. It's within the community, you know, and it's just crabs in a barrel mentality to me is what it is.
There's a lot to be learned from this, isn't
there,
Derek?
Sure.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Sounds like a fascinating play.
It'll be
a great play.
We're opening on the 13th of this month, and we'll be closing on February 5th.
Sounds good.
So please, I'd like to encourage everyone to come down to the TAG Brad Powell Theater.
Yeah.
And we have a real good show for you.
Derek Brown is the director of Yellow Man, Actors Group Production. And as he just said, January 13th to February 5th at the Brad Powell Theater in Honolulu. Details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Bloody history repeating itself in Chicago.
From a street ethics aspect, you feel that what you're doing is noble. You know, this is my guys, this is my crew, this is who I'm with, and so we're going to defend us and ours at all costs.
Gang history lessons for now. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
Today, the Honolulu Police Commission is scheduled to discuss the future of HPD's chief. The meeting is behind closed doors, and that's just what public interest attorneys say shouldn't happen. Civil Bee reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So is this really a basic conflict between, you know, transparency of sunshine law and a private personnel matter about a public official?
You know, the law does grant the police commission, as well as other state agencies, to go into executive session when it involves, well, someone's employment, a personnel matter. And that is very much the case here with Chief Louis Kealoha. The agenda for the commission is to hire or evaluate or dismiss or discipline an employee. And the law allows them to do that behind closed doors. But if you talk to attorneys like Jeff Portnoy or Brian Black, they say, you know, there's a public interest also at stake here. The sunshine law, of course, is to allow sunshine into these darkened rooms so that we can find out what's going on. As Black put it, you know, there are serious allegations against Chief Kealoha, as we have been talking about quite a lot on the conversation. Is the commission doing their job? So it's a very sensitive question. There are good arguments on both sides, but the reality check is the police commission does have the right to do this behind closed doors.
So as they will be debating this and talking about it, what has to happen for them to be able to render a decision?
Max Sword, the police commission chair, said that they will be talking. They will go into open session after they meet today. By the way, that meeting starts at 2. No idea how long that may last. There probably will not be any action per se in terms of a firing or discipline, because the commission has to give notice. It's part of the protocol. So let's say, for example, they decided to fire him or discipline him. The chief would have a chance to respond. And as one commissioner told Nick Ruby, our reporter, there probably would be a hearing so that the chief could give his side and defend himself. And presumably that hearing would be something in public. So it's really a moving target right now. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but this is the first big step. You know, as you know, the commission's meeting for the first time in a couple of weeks because of the holidays, and the chief, as we also know, is on paid leave right now.
And now we have newly appointed Commissioner Stephen Levinson, part of that, as a former Associate Justice on the Hawaii Supreme Court. Did he have a different take on this? I know he's the one that said that the hearing would have to happen, but does he have any different ideas about this from what we've been hearing up to this point?
He also recognizes the personal privacy. The courts have made that a priority. I mean, it is part of the law. Former Justice Levinson, always very much about public accountability and transparency, too. So I think they are trying to walk that fine line to make sure they're doing something that's fair. The justice is one of several new commissioners that have brought some new blood to the board. As you know, the former chair stepped down, Ron Takeda, replaced by Max Sword. So we'll see. Having said that, there are a number of board members who are very much in support of the chief. It's a 7-member board, and I think we'll be finding out shortly what's going to happen next. But in terms of a decisive decision today, I don't know that it's going to come today. We'll see.
Well, likely not if we've already heard that there would have to be a hearing. But it seems, though, that because they're walking such a fine line, that regardless, you're going to have a lot of people who think that whatever happens, it was the wrong decision.
No question about that. But this has been going on a long time. Remember, there's a federal investigation going on. These are serious charges of corruption, conspiracy. And, of course, the chief needs to have his day in court if it comes to that.
All right, we're going to leave it there. See what happens later on this afternoon. And we'll talk to you tomorrow morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us daily from Civil Beat with a reality check. In the recently released United Health Foundation's annual ranking of states' health, Hawaii took the top spot for the 5th straight year. It might be no coincidence that Hawaii's prepaid health care decades before it was mandated by the Affordable Care Act had something to do with that. As we went into last weekend, Hawaii was granted a state innovation waiver for the ACA's Small Business Health Options Program. Meanwhile, uncertainty over the ACA continues, as we've heard a lot about today, with Republican efforts to repeal or at least dismantle parts of the ACA, and yet with no indication of possible replacements. George Green is the head of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. He joins us now with some of his thoughts about where Hawaii is going. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're in the enviable position of very soon to be making an exit from Hawaii, but having had so much influence here and longstanding experience with what has happened under the ACA, that I'm wondering if you are now looking back over your shoulder and wondering if the connector and all of what Hawaii has been through was in somewhat a red herring.
I'm not sure that it was a red herring. You know, I think that everyone understood that the Affordable Care Act was sort of a one-size-fits-all new law that made an attempt to try and improve health care, which was needed. I think over the years since its implementation, there's been a realization that you can't have such a broad-based and far-reaching law without recognizing the nuances of different states and different locales. And as you mentioned, with our Prepaid Health Care Act here, I think that we were in a much better situation than many states across the country, because historically we've been able to keep the numbers of uninsured low here in Hawaii. So I think what you see is playing out, or has played out, is that at least under the Obama administration, there's been some recognition that they've been providing some flexibility to recognize that this one-size-fits-all law needed to be tweaked in order to address the concerns of local, of regional or state localities. And so I think the state innovation waivers, which they've allowed, really allow states to apply and demonstrate that we can actually come up with solutions or workarounds within the guidelines of the Affordable Care Act that best suit our patients and our populations in our state. And that's exactly what the state of Hawaii has done.
The case that you've made was an argument that we heard years and years ago as the ACA was just coming into being. Was there any way in your mind that Hawaii could have avoided all of this by simply having better made the case that it should have been an exception way back when?
Well, I think the short answer is no, because in the way that the Affordable Care Act was rolled out, and with the pressures that were placed on the Obama administration, I think that they essentially had to use force of personality and force of party in order to get something passed. And I think in the manner in which they had to pass it, it didn't really leave room to recognize those nuances as the bill was rolled out. Having said that, there was a coalition that involved the Healthcare Association of Hawaii working with our congressional delegation, really led by then-Senator Inouye's office, where we did achieve inclusion of language in the Affordable Care Act that said that unless the Affordable Care Act, at the end of the day, would provide better health care than the Prepaid Health Care Act, the Prepaid Health Care Act would still be in effect. And so there was some language that was included in the law to attempt to protect the Prepaid Health Care Act.
As we've heard today, the president has been having meetings to try to safeguard Obamacare, but we've also heard for all of the campaign leading up to the presidential election and through it that, you know, Republicans want to see it dismantled and possibly replaced with something else, but we don't know what that might be yet. As you look forward, what do you see that might be a reasonable expectation and surely with a time frame attached to that?
Well, I think it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. You know, if there are changes that are made that result in people who have been provided coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act no longer being able to access health insurance, then I think in 2 years the Republicans may look back on taking any drastic measures and have some regrets when it's time for their constituencies to decide who they should vote into office during the midterm. There are some things that have worked really, really well about the Affordable Care Act. And again, what I think is going to happen, I think that they may pass a bill that is titled as the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but I don't think they're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think the moderate Republicans all along have recognized that there are good components of the Affordable Care Act. And if they do decide to repeal it, I think that some of the better provisions will still survive. We don't know what that's going to look like. I think everyone is waiting on bated breath because there are significant cuts that the healthcare industry essentially agreed to in order to fund healthcare reform or the Affordable Care Act. And if it's repealed, then what you're going to see are a lot of healthcare providers coming forward and saying, I agreed to basically agree to cuts on my reimbursement for taking care of the Medicaid population, the Medicare population. And now you're saying that this population is going to receive less insurance, then we're not going to agree to those cuts continuing, so you're going to need to either give us a refund or look at how you're going to increase our Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements and really recognize the increase in uncompensated care that would occur as a result of those individuals who had insurance under the Affordable Care Act no longer having insurance.
George Green, we've got to go in just a second, but I wanted to ask you, as you see this playing out on the national scene, for Hawaii in particular, given Hawaii's stance and the long-standing attention that we've placed on prepaid health care, do you see any changes or impacts to Hawaii that would be different from other places?
Here would be my answer for you. I think that Hawaii needs to stand strong with health care providers, community stakeholders, and legislators at the state and federal level to continue to dialogue with organizations such as CMS and the new administration and demonstrate the good that the Prepaid Health Care Act has done since 1974. We are a model for the rest of the country. And when I meet with my peers across the country, many of them really admire the work that was done in implementing the Prepaid Health Care Act and frankly wish that they had something similar in place in their states because it has worked so well. And I think that the waiver is a good first step. And I think that as long as our legislators and our healthcare providers stand strong, I think that it is possible for us to protect the Prepaid Health Care Act, hopefully in perpetuity.
George Green, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
George Green is the president and chief executive officer of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, at least until mid-month. He'll leave to become the president and CEO of the Hospital Association of Southern California.
Hi, good morning. I'm Darren Kamali from New Zealand Aotearoa, born and raised in Fiji. I'm here in a residency at UHM Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Tonight at 5, we'll be bringing you Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa, and Bert's on the line to talk about a couple of startup companies.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, you know, the folks over at Blue Startups, they have their latest cohort. They're coming up with graduation. They're going to be doing a event called East Meets West, but we've already talked about that. We're going to actually invite a couple of the companies that have gone through the program this past cohort and talk to them about how their experience was. They actually, these two have been selected because they are both in this kind of a real estate, real property sector, mm-hmm. and we wanted to find out what opportunities do startups have in that particular area.
Well, what do they tell you so far about that?
Well, you know, we've not really talked to too many that are in this sector, and it's interesting that, you know, there's two of them in the cohort right now. One does what called realty returns, and I guess they provide small investors, you know, people like you and me, to participate in perhaps an investment in real estate and get a return on that investment. The other one is called the condo app, and it provides the managers of the condo to have better access to the tenants of the condo so that there's ways that they can facilitate better communications.
So really, it often seems, Bert, as if there's no application that hasn't been addressed by these startups. And yet there seems to be room for more all the time.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, think about any process that takes place, and is there a way that technology can play a role in that? I think that's where some of these startups come up with their ideas.
Well, be interesting to keep track of that. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m. In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered the first TV show set in Hawaii, Hawaiian Eye, and the local comedian who supplied much of its local color. He played a character called Kazuo Kim Kisado, and the show's open featured him floating on an inner tube, wearing his trademark straw hat and stroking a ukulele. He was born on Maui in 1933 and served as an army corporal in Germany before coming home to pursue a show business career. He got his big break on a live weekend amateur talent show in L.A. called Rocket to Stardom that was broadcast from a Wilshire Boulevard automobile showroom. That led to nightclub gigs, and when the Warner Brothers producers of A New Private Eye show saw him, his career was launched. His presence on the show gave it what little authenticity it had. Although it was set in Hawaii, most of its scenes were shot on a Burbank, California back lot. Viewers from back in the day still remember Ponciano Tabac Ponce, or Poncy Ponce.
And Keith Haugen called us and knew the answer, and will be receiving the HPR prize. Good for you. Thanks so much for playing with us on the Backyard Quiz. And if you have a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and it just might show up on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, hosting the annual Literacy Leadership Conference and Student Celebrations, February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Growing old is never easy, and women in America face a special burden, the weight of societal expectations about how they look. In an appearance-obsessed society, women are bombarded by images of the young and perfectly formed, and encouraged to compare themselves to an impossible standard. Maui playwright and performer Sharon Stone's new musical, Old Girls Looking Hot, strikes back at what popular culture expects of her, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, Chris.
I sense that this play came from a pretty deeply felt place in you.
Oh, you think?
Just a wild guess, you know.
Yes, you know, I've never been a rampant feminist, but as I get older and I look in the mirror and I see what's going on in my head and I feel wisdom happening, which is rather nice, there are some compensations. And I think we, as women aging, are actually coming into a more powerful and creative process. And I found that happening with myself for the last 20 years. I'm 64 years old. And I have been wanting to do this kind of show for about the last 20 years. And I feel now the time is extra ripe, of course, because we have a new president. And the image he is portraying of women is one that I thought went out about 20 or 30 years ago. So I think this play is extremely relevant right now.
You mean you're talking about the whole idea of locker room banter, right?
Oh, my gosh. Ooh. What can I say? Ooh.
Yeah, I would share that opinion. But, you know, at the same time, you talked about growing in wisdom. And I think one of the compensations of aging, one of the few, is you do get a little smarter, don't you?
Oh, well, thank heaven for that.
No yes. kidding, yeah.
Yes, we would definitely we definitely want to, because it's not like we have a lot of choice in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you look in the mirror and you see these changes, but you don't feel any different. And that's often a little hard to get one's head around. So I look in the mirror and I see my eyes and I see my face. Go, oh, not too bad. And then you see yourself in a photograph and go, oh, my gosh, who's that old bag?
Yeah.
So we have this inner vision of ourselves, and then we have the vision that everybody else sees. And we've got to make those two meld. And the title of this show actually came from a real-life meeting I had. I was up in the old upcountry fitness gym here doing my best to sweat it out, and I used to go on a reasonably regular basis. And this old guy came up to me, and he said, you know, I've been really watching you for a while now. I've got to tell you how great it is to see old girls like you looking hot. Well, I nearly slapped him, of course.
Yeah.
But then as I went home, I thought, wow, what a great show title.
Well,
so
yeah.
I have to thank him. If he's still alive, I have to thank him.
It's a pretty awkward idea of a compliment, but it does make a good show title.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I had to think about it for a while.
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of thing that men say when they think they're being nice, but they're really not, because...
Right? Well, he will be forever captured in one of my monologues. So my friend Scott Newman is playing what I call sleazy old guy, and he does a wonderful job. So well, it's going to give a lot of people a chuckle, because I'm sure I'm not the only older lady who goes to the gym in an effort to stay younger.
And he's probably
not some of the interactions you get at these places.
He's also probably not the only sleazy old guy out there, Sharon.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
You know, obviously. Men go through this too, but I do think it's a little bit more burdensome for women, don't you?
Well, I do believe that, yeah, because all our advertising is slanted towards young, sexy women in bikinis and looking fabulous, but not much of our advertising caters to reality. And the reality is we do get older.
Yeah.
But is that old... equated with ugly? And no, it should not be. And I think that's part of the getting of wisdom, is you realize what's going on inside you is actually much more important than what is going on outside. This year I lost my mother. I beg your pardon, last year now. But I watched what she went through for the last 5 years of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched what was going on outside, and she was a tortured soul. So I watched what was going on inside, and it was quite frightening. And I thought, I don't ever want to end up like that. I don't want to be bitter and alone. I want to be beautiful. I want love and be loved.
Well, Sharon, some of that torture that she experienced, was that based on ideas of appearance and, you know, the whole emphasis on looks and youth in the society?
It definitely was. But for her, she could also see, my mother was a very intellectual woman, and she could see the gifts she had fading.
Mm-hmm.
And... I could also see in her the fear of what was next.
Sure.
The fear of dying. And I thought, you know, we have to come to terms with that, because it's not like we get a whole lot of choice. But, of course, we're always going to ask those questions. What's next?
But the whole idea is to come with some sort of reconciliation with yourself about...
Absolutely.
About how you look, about how you think, about all those things, and be ready.
Absolutely, and it's realizing what is important in this life, and what is important is being hot on the inside, not just on the outside. And if we can come to that true realization, And we often come to it with regrets and sense of humor and hard lessons learned along the way. But if we can come to that realization, then I think we do come to a place of peace. But definitely with lots of laughter along the way, because I think you do need to be able to laugh at yourself.
I couldn't agree more, Sharon. Thanks so much for taking the time, and good luck with your show. Thanks for talking with us.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Chris. Hopefully you can get over here and see it, huh?
That'd be great. That'd be great. Sharon Stone is the author of and performs in Old Girls Looking Hot, a musical that runs from January 20th to 22nd at the historic Iao Theater in Wailuku, Maui. You can get showtimes and more information from our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Beth Ann, I loved that story that Sharon just told me about having a guy come up to her in the gym and say, "For an old girl, you look hot," and thinking he was doing her a favor.
Well, how people deliver compliments can leave a lot to be desired. But you know, but the point of it that she's really making is that even as women and men age, that the ideas that we have of ourselves and how we look out through our own eyes is very different from the people looking at us. But it doesn't necessarily have to mean that it's less than. It could be something that's far greater. But we have to be willing to acknowledge that in each other. And very often with so much media coming at us that tells us it should be anything but that, it's really hard to do.
And we have to remember that those people who are encouraging us to be self-critical about our appearance are trying to sell us something.
Always good to remember that one, especially when you step up to the cosmetics counter.
That's right.
That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday morning. We're going to be back with you tomorrow. Now, you know, the OHA board has changed, and we're going to take a look at its future with OHA board chair Rowena Akana.
And we'll look at dancing moms at the Oahu Fringe Festival.
And they'll look hot, too.
Yeah, no doubt. We like to hear from you. You can call us at our talk back line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or just want to hear something again, take a look at the archive on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.